There's only one.
I'm going to call the Tax Committee order. Sorry, members, that I was late a little bit. We're going to start with Representative Dabney's bill today. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 2847 to be before the committee and laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Tax Bill.
Okay, so Representative Dabney moves House File 2847 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Tax Bill. Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair and members, this bill seeks to follow through on the commitment that we as a legislature and the state made to this hydroelectric project in 2006 by extending the sales and use tax exemption for the Lower St. Anthony Falls hydroelectric plant for one calendar year. As I said, in 2006, we made that commitment. It's a common commitment to large public utility projects around the state, nothing unusual there. They would have been able to fulfill the completion within the timeline had the 35W bridge not collapsed on their project. In your packets, members, free from my office and the good people at MnDOT, you're getting a highway map today. Please drive carefully. Don't read it while you're driving. Pull over to the side. Use your cell phone. Call your friends. Use the map. But you can see on here the dam. That is where the hydroelectric project is. You can see then its proximity to the new 35W bridge, which you'll recall was built on the location of the old 35W bridge. If you went down there, please don't, you're not wearing the right shoes, you would see this and the bulkhead for the construction of the dam right, for the construction of the plant right here. If you just turn around and face the other way, eek, there's the bridge. That's just how close it was. So when the 35W bridge collapsed, the Army Corps of Engineers said, stop building your plant. They've, I believe also in your packets, I'm not certain of this, is a letter from the nice people at FERC, the Federal Electricity, whatever they are, giving the plant an extension on its licensure and related issues because of the unavoidable delay from the collapse of the bridge. This merely extends the sales tax and use tax exemption to allow them to complete the project and follow through on our commitment to them.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Dabney? Representative Brett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, I don't think it's for Representative Dabney, but maybe Ms. Dalton. I think I ask this every year, and so you probably were anticipating my my question. You know, it seems like doing these individual exemptions is something we continue to do, and we always play along, which I think is appropriate. Especially Representative Dabney, in your case, I absolutely support what you're doing. But it seems to me that a blanket exemption might make some sense at some point in the future, and I'm wondering what type of price tag that would have.
Ms. Dalton, Madam Chair, Representative Broad, I don't know what the price tag would be. there might be somebody from the department here who might have a better idea, but I do know that that's really why we've never done it.
Representative Broad, further?
No.
Further question, Representative Liebling, please.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I might be able to give you sort of a very, very loose ballpark for that because I think in my first term, you know, and I'm in my third term now, so this is a little bit old. I had a bill to do that, and I got a revenue estimate on it, and I think it was around $80 million. So maybe that's helpful.
Thank you.
And that's why I didn't go anywhere.
Public testimony on this bill, for or against? Anybody want to say anything to us about this bill? Representative Broad.
Actually, you know what I'm thinking about? Representative Liebling, that's a big number. I'm curious if that was repealing is income or sales tax for all local government purchases, because I seem to recall that that number was pretty consistent with the bill that both you, I think, and Representative Atkins had carried. And by the way, Madam Chair, I support that bill too, but there's no money to get us there. But, you know, I would be interested. I don't need the number today, but I would be interested in getting the number from the department related to a blanket exemption so that we don't in the future ever see, and Madam Chair, you have done a great job not doing this, but just so we don't ever see, a selective selective exemptions going on, and so just information. Thanks.
Okay, and maybe Ms. Dalton though could give us, you know, the exempt the sales tax for local units. I thought that was more like 130, but What is that number?
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, yeah, I think that's somewhere in the $100 to $150 million to do the exemption for local governments. I think one of the problems with doing the construction exemptions, it's how broad are they? Okay. Do you limit them just to utilities? Do you limit them to all... do you limit them just to electric utilities? You do all types of utilities, and then you start getting into other types of construction projects.
Representative Liebling, did you do all kinds of utilities, do you recall? Well, Representative Broad made the request on the tape here to the department, and maybe some of the department can just provide the whole committee with a memo kind of in general what all the utilities would be with certain parameters and just a ballpark so we understand that going forward. Thank you. Further questions for Representative Dammey? Other public testimony? If not, we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
And we were going to call up Representative Paymar, but we don't see him. So we're going to go to the governor's technical bill, House File 2971, and I'll move that for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And we'll hear from the governor's folks on the technical bill. House File 2971. Members will recall we tried to do the policy bill and the technical bill, and we never even got to the technical bill because we got all into the assessors versus appraisers debate, and then we sent that off to Representative Mullery. So now we're coming back and trying to hear the governor's other bill this year for the policy technical cluster. Welcome to the committee.
Here. Stephen Krenkel, Department of Revenue, testifying on Article 1 of the technical bill. It's the individual income and corporate franchise tax provisions. I'll begin with Section 7 and 8 because they relate back to the change in Section 1. Section 7 and 8 repeal obsolete language for a small ethanol producer credit. They have expired by their own terms. Section 1 is a cross-reference correction, as are Sections 9 through 13. Section 7 and 8 are the actual deletions of the obsolete credit.
Can I interrupt? I'm sorry. Okay, so members who are trying to follow along, it's a little confusing. It looks like the revenue estimate, but it's actually turn inside, and you can march through all articles of the summary with the testimony here. I think we're just trying to find it. So it's the one that starts with the revenue estimate. The summary is inside. Sorry to interrupt you. Thank you.
Certainly. Section 2 changes the date that mutual funds pay municipal bond interest must provide statements to their investors from January 13th to 15th. This is a federal conformity issue. And also in that amendment, it changes the date mutual funds must file the same statements with the Department of Revenue from March 15th to June 1st, rather. Section 3, another federal conformity matter, it simply is a change from a description of the federal due dates to the federal due dates for corporate franchise tax returns. What has happened is we've had taxpayers call in and after they read through all the deleted language in those in Section 3, they say, does this mean that we file on the federal due date? The answer is yes. So we decided to simply put that in plain language in the statute. Section 4, another federal conformity matter, clarifies that when an estate elects to defer paying Minnesota estate tax, it would pay on an installment plan, and it makes a corresponding federal election. It must follow the federal treatment in determining the proportion of the total amount of Minnesota tax that is eligible for deferred payment. Section 5 amends language regarding a frivolous return penalty. There's some inconsistent language in the statute now, and it simply changes to a consistent use of the term taxpayer. Section 6 clarifies that the addition for municipal bond interest paid by a mutual fund does not include territorial bonds. We are precluded from including those amounts of interest by federal legislation. It simply puts the same requirement in the Minnesota statutes. And Section 6 also clarifies that the territorial bonds that are included in the denominator of an apportionment factor to determine whether the 95% threshold is met it's used to determine whether the municipal bond interest is sufficiently attributable to Minnesota. So it is another correction that is required by the federal treatment of the bonds. So that's the run through for Article 1.
Thank you. I'm going to interrupt before we jump ahead and ask Representative Root if she'd be willing, and I forgot there were a couple amendments that the governor's staff would like added to the bill. So, Representative Root?
Thank you. Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the A-10 2075 amendment.
So, Representative Broad moves, or, sorry, Representative Root.
Close.
Both end in D, and they're both four letters. Moves the A-10-2075 amendment. Discussion of the amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion carries. So that's been amended. And Representative Broad. Representative Root. Sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would also like to move the H-297-1A-1 amendment.
And Representative Root moves the H-297-1A-1. Discussion to the amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
We'll say nay. Motion carries. Okay, so we've got the amendments that the governor's staff wanted in the bill. Thank you. Please, welcome to the committee.
My name is Susan Berry. I'll be going through the sales tax article. The first section is regarding the combined sales tax rate. Under the Constitution, we're supposed to apply an additional of 3.75% to the sales tax rate for a period. And the Department of Revenue has been administering this so that it will apply to all the taxes and the exemptions throughout the sales tax chapter. However, we've taken the position that combined rate does not apply to the sale of manufactured homes, since the additional rate is on the gross receipts, but the sales tax on manufactured homes is not on gross receipts from retail sales, but on 65% of the dealer's cost. So our language clarifies that the combined rate applies throughout the chapter, but not to subdivision 3 on manufactured homes. And Madam Chair, I understand that you have an amendment to this article, or have you already done that?
Representative Rue just moved that.
So that one is an in now.
Okay. It's in now, yes.
All right. The second article is on the 120 days to obtain an exemption certificate. The current law relieves sellers of liabilities from sales tax if the seller provides substantiation of sales tax exemptions to the commissioner within 120 days of the request of the commissioner. This clarifies that if the seller does not provide that substantiation until after 120 days, the exemption is going to be disallowed. Section 3, regarding transitional periods for pre-existing contracts or bids if there is a tax rate increase. Since the seller only is required to accept fully completed exemption certificates from the purchasers, this deletes the language that requires the purchaser to give any documentation to the seller, and also specifically requires the contractor to keep that documentation if it's needed for review in the future. Section 4, when Minnesota Chapter 297A was recodified in the year 2000, the word nonprofit, the nonprofit designation, was inadvertently admitted, and this clarifies that for those organizations that exist solely for the purpose of providing educational and social activities for young people, that they need to be nonprofit. And Section 5 is an amendment to a section law for the exemption from the 5% motor vehicle rental fee. It clarifies that section applied to leases and rentals rather than to registrations. And that's the article.
Thank you, Ms. Berry. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, my name is Michal Garber, and I'll go over Article 3, which is the special taxes article. Section 1 deals with obtaining coverage from an ineligible surplus lines insurer. This is a Commerce Department provision which provides cross-reference to Chapter 297I, which is the tax chapter. Clarifies that a surplus lines licensee is required to pay the tax on purchasing insurance from an ineligible insurer. Sections 2 and 3 are Minnesota care provisions. They deal with underpayments of estimated tax. They provide a safe harbor to a new business which is not required to make estimated payments during the first year of business. Section 4 is a cigarette tax provision. It deals with sales to non-qualified buyers. It deletes an obsolete reference to selling contraband cigarettes. Section 5 is an insurance tax provision, and it deals with return due dates. Deletes obsolete references to other sections in Chapter 297I and gives specific due dates for filing returns for certain taxes. Section 6 deals with return due dates for surplus lines tax and deletes obsolete references. Section 6, 7, and 8 clarify the provision dealing with forms prescribed by the commissioner to be consistent with other similar provisions. Section 9 deals with electronic payments of insurance tax and corrects inconsistency in the law versus the effective date to make sure that the threshold period is the fiscal year ending June 30th. Section 10 and Section 11 deal with a correction of obsolete references to other sections in 297I. Section 12 is the distribution of, deals with distribution of production tax proceeds and corrects a reference from tax relief area to taconite assistance area. And Section 13 is a repealer. It repeals provisions dealing with due dates of filing returns, and this provision is replaced with changes in Section 5. Yes. And this concludes Article 3.
Thank you, Ms. Garber. Appreciate that. Thanks. Mr. Nord, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jason Nord from the Department of Revenue, and Lance Streak will actually walk through Article 4 for you, but before he gets to that, I'll give you a quick summary of what the amendment was. The 810-2075 amendment deals with the bovine tuberculosis credit. And it corrects what we believe was just a technical oversight when the law was originally drafted and makes it explicitly clear that the Department of Education is responsible for reimbursing the school districts, while the Department of Revenue reimburses all other jurisdictions other than the school districts. The language as it had passed had included a reference to the Ag Preserves Law for the timing of the repayment of the credit, and that credit is one that, again, the Department of Education pays to the school districts, the Department of Revenue pays to other jurisdictions. So we've added these two sections to make it explicitly clear and confirm current interpretation and current practice.
Thank you, Mr. Nard. Mr. Sirica.
Madam Chair, my name is Lance DeRica. I'm here on behalf of the Department of Revenue to go through Article 4, except for the A10 amendment that was adopted. Article 4 basically contains 11 sections that are correcting and updating references within the statutes. Section 1 has to do with regional library support grant requirements. It was changed last year to make some changes related to unallotments. There were a couple of technical changes, changing a reference to the old HACA statute, and we corrected that to reference the new market value homestead credit statute. There was a couple of times it referred to credit reductions when actually the credit reimbursements were reduced. Section 2 corrects a reference so that when the department issues the assessor's manual, we don't have to do that by promulgating the manual as a rule. This conforms to longstanding practice. Section 3 makes it clear that when there's a wind energy production tax facility inside of a job zone, the qualifying business, in order to qualify, has to have signed the business subsidy agreement. Section 4 has to do with the new rural preserve property tax program rural reserve property tax program that was enacted, I believe it was last year. There's a provision in there about land that cannot also be enrolled in other programs, and we are striking the prohibition against being enrolled under the reference in the statute is to 273.117. That has to do with a valuation adjustment when warranted for conservation easements. We don't think that's inconsistent with the rural reserve program. We are, however, adding a prohibition against the property also being enrolled in the Metropolitan Ag Preserves Program because that does provide literally the same benefits, the same valuation benefits. Section 5 has to do with the truth in taxation. Last year, There was a change made so that the meetings, the truth and taxation meetings, are not required, but the wording of the law left some questions. I'm reading on page 33, lines 9 and 10. The time and what the law said now was the time and the place of the taxing authority's regular scheduled meetings in which budget and levy will be discussed. Without going further, that left a lot of local units thinking they had to give a special notice for almost every meeting they had. These changes just clarify that it is they only need to give the special notice with regard to one meeting at which the budget and levy will be discussed before adoption. Sections 6, 7, and 9 have to do with levy limitations. Again, they're making, updating and correcting references. Last year, there's some enactments. Last year, there were some enactments involving, again, accommodating for allotments. One of the things we had to adjust to was this phrase, when allotments occur, the question became, how do they account it for in levy limits? There's a phrase in the levy law where such a lot, where we are subtract aides that are certified to be received under a certain set of statutes. Basically, the levy limit is computed from the last year's amount. You get an increase for growth, and then we subtract the new year's aides. If the new year aides go down, the levy limit goes up. If the new year's aides go down, go up, the levy limit goes down. In allotments, there's a question of how that should be taken. And then, of course, there are special levies that are taken outside of the levy limit. So when allotments occur, there's a question of how they should be incorporated into the levy limits, if at all. First of all, we had a long-standing interpretation that the aides certified to be received under these statutory sections were the aides that we certified, the amounts that we certified that they would receive, not necessarily the amounts they would end up receiving after an allotment. We had that interpretation. We looked at what the legislature had done with regard to allotments and levy limits last year. We listened to the discussions from the interested parties. As far as legislative actions, we saw that three special levies, depends on how you count them, but basically there were three special levies that were changed, and this subtraction that I talk about was not changed. So when we looked at our longstanding interpretation in light of legislative actions, to have changed the subtraction when the legislature didn't, but when the legislature instead made other changes, didn't seem to be the appropriate thing to do at that time. And even if we had done that administratively, we would have only solved part of the problem. If that only would have allowed the local government aid and county program aid on allotments to be automatically flowed through, it still would have left the market value credit on allotments would have to be dealt with the way that we are clarifying here for all of the unallotments, again, because we think this was legislative intent. And the final problem is that back July, August, September of last year, when we were computing the levy limits for taxes payable this year and certifying the aides for payment in this year, it was too late to make an automatic adjustment to the levy limits at our level for the unallotments that would affect the aid paid in 2009, because we were working on levy limits and aids to be paid in 2010. And it was too early to make that kind of adjustment for the unallotments affecting aids payable in 2010, because they were still subject to change. Under our method, no unit should be precluded from recovering the full amount of their unallotment should they choose to do so. In detail, going back to detail, in Section 6, there's two things happening. The first thing that happens in Section 6 is to make sure that the special levy for principal and interest on certificates of indebtedness is available for levies to repay indebtedness related to the new emergency certificates of indebtedness that were authorized last year. And that shows up in the bill in Section 9, where again we clarify that in order to levy to repay these emergency debt certificates, it is to be done under this clause of the special levy. The other thing happening in Section 6 has to do with Clause 22. which allows a special levy enacted last year for reductions to the bulk government aid and county program aids. And this basically clarifies that if the amount is known by September 1 of the levy year, you can include, this special levy will cover that. If the amount is not known by September 1 of the levy year, they can either levy it under this special levy the next year or recertify their levy and use this. But again, it just clarifies that this is the special levy under which to do that. Section 7 adds a paragraph to the levy limit computations to clarify that the levy limit computations aren't changed by unallotments, but instead that the it doesn't say this, but the intent is to have the special levies cover the unallotments. Section 8 has to do with confession of judgment for delinquent taxes, property taxes. In there, there's in the current law, there's a reference to timberland. I think it was 2008. We changed the classification statute for property tax purposes. We no longer have a literal timberland classification. It's our understanding that land that was in the old timberland classification will now either be have changed the use, but if it has the same use, it would be either rural vacant land or managed forest land. So by updating these references, we don't think there will be any change. Section 10 has to do with local government aid. As I understand that the problem was that local government aid was volatile. Legislators would go home from the session thinking they had voted for a certain local government aid formula, and the results that were that obtain under that formula, and they would go home from the session and find out in August when we did the actual calculations that maybe a population number had changed or some other data input had changed to the formula from what was estimated at session time, and so that their local units would get different amounts. And there were some attempts to change the law to make those amounts less volatile. There's an exception. So the fix, if you will, was to kind of freeze some of the data as of January 1 in the year when we're calculating the aids. There's an exception that was always intended to that, and it has to do with the I can't do it from memory, but it has to do with the minimums and maximum increases and decreases. Those are pegged to an aid plus levy amount, and it was always intended that the levy amount wouldn't be the levy amount from January 1 of the aid calculation year because they're not available at that time. So we tried to correct that in 2000, correct this provision in 2009 to make that exception to the freezing of the data. We got it wrong, and we're back. We think we have it right this time. Section 11 has to do with emergency medical service districts. Last year, there were two changes made. One extended the substantive law permanently, but then extended the statute that defines those units as taxing districts. That was only extended for taxes payable through 2012. Section 11 extends both of those permanently. At the end of Article 4.
Thank you, Mr. Sirica. And before we do want to, we have people on the question list, but we want to get through all the testimony on revenue, so we do want to do Article 5. But before that, we want to hear from Representative Dietrich. Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to introduce the ninth grade students from Champlain Park High School. They are here participating in the Minnesota Historical Society Capital Historic Sites program called Voice of the People, Your Role in Minnesota Government. So Champlain Park High School students, would you wave or stand up or do something so that we can
sit on the
see you?
Thank you very much. We're glad you're here. Thank you. So Article 5, and we do want to get to Representative Paymar's bill today, too. So with that, we're going to try to get through all the revenue testimony before we take questions. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mark Peterson. I'm attorney with the department. I'll go through the last article. Section 1 amends the blanket abatement of late filing, late payment penalties for persons affected by natural disasters. Current law applies to persons located in a presidentially declared disaster. The proposal is to change the law to make that also apply to presidentially declared states of emergency and governor-declared disasters. The only difference in those designations really is the effect of the disaster on the state, the local, the national economies, as it applies to affected taxpayers. A flood is a flood. Section 2 amends the Job Z waiver repayment statute. Job Z businesses that close down or otherwise fail are required to repay 2 years' worth of benefits. They're also allowed to ask the Commissioner of Revenue to waive the repayment. There's no time limit, though, for requesting the waiver. So the change is to require the waiver to be made within 60 days after the county sends a property tax bill or 60 days after the Commissioner of Revenue sends an order assessing the repayment. That is generally the time the taxpayers have to appeal orders of the commissioner. And the third section also is Job Z related. Job Z businesses are required to file two annual returns or statements, reports to the Department of Revenue. One is a summary of the tax benefits that they received in the prior year. That one is due October 15th. The second one is an annual certification of the Commissioner of Revenue that the business is in compliance with its business subsidy agreement. That report is due December 1st. The change is to make both of these due on October 15th, which will be easier for taxpayers, easier for revenue, easier for deed, and easier for local economic development and property tax administrators.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Okay, so we have questions. First, Representative Marquardt, then Loeffler.
Thank you,
Bertha. And, you know, this is on the whole thing, and we'll take public testimony if there's any on this, too. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. The question for the department, could you tell me on Article 4, those levy limitations, Section 6, 7, and 9, and Section 10, the one on local government aid, are those okay with the local units of government?
Mr. Sterica, or who wants to cover that? Mr. Nord?
I mean, it sounded a little complicated in parts there, so I just...
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, I believe that Keith Carlson has a comment that he would like to make on Section 7. Otherwise, I don't think we've heard any controversy regarding those provisions.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And they're all here, so when we get to the public testimony, they might tell us. Representative Loeffler, then Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Mr. Peterson. The area I'm concerned about is... just trying to understand the Job Z time limit for requesting waiver of a clawback, since we're being challenged to provide a lot more support to new businesses that want to start up with lots of promise. How many businesses fail, and how many of them request this waiver, and how many of them are successful in being granted a waiver?
Sir, Madam Chair, Representative, we've had about I don't know exactly how many have closed down. There are a lot that have that are no longer meeting the job requirements in their business subsidy agreement. Pursuant to a law change a couple years ago, those businesses are no longer subject to clawback. They just don't get any benefits going forward, and they can, in some instances, go to deed and get a shortened Job Z duration. We've reviewed somewhere between 15 and 20 waiver requests in the last 2 or 3 years. I think maybe two-thirds to three-quarters of them were granted in full. A couple of them were granted partially, and a couple of them were denied.
Madam Chair, if we could just get some summary information, that would be useful to me as we evaluate all these proposals to expand this kind of a concept. Thank you.
Mr. Peterson, maybe you and Mr. Loftus could kind of figure out how we could get that information to Representative Loeffler and the whole committee. So Mr. Loftus is here too, so be good to know. And then we have Liebling, Representative Solberg, was that to that point? Okay, Representative Solberg.
It would be good to already know the number, but the percentage.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate that. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question about Article 2, Section 4. This fundraising exemption, to make it explicit that organizations that exist solely for the purpose of providing educational or social activities to young people must be nonprofit in order for their sales or fundraising to be exempt. The question is, it's fine that this is a clarification, but I'm wondering if anybody is going to be affected by this. Are there organizations that are going to be that believe that it's the way it was written and that are now going to be surprised by losing this exemption?
Ms. Berry.
Madam Chair, Representative, we're not aware of any organizations that will be affected by this. At least they haven't told us that they would be affected by this. If anyone is looking for this exemption, they would be applying for us to make sure that they meet the requirements, and so we would have been telling them. If they had been applying as being other than nonprofit, we would have been telling them that they didn't meet the exemption.
Thank you. So I'm understanding that this is sort of a preemptive just for going forward to make sure that you don't have a problem. It's not.
Right. We just recognize that when, Madam Chair, Representative, we recognize that when the statute was recodified, that inadvertently that word was left out, but it's always been the intent.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions at this time. So public testimony on the governor's technical bill. Is there anybody who would like to tell us something about any part of the bill? So get that on the record. Mr. Carlson, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Keith Carlson with the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and the concerns that I'm going to raise are also shared by the Association of Minnesota Counties. Our concerns are with the mechanics of the levy limit as enumerated in Section 7 of Article 4, starting on page 39, and also the special levy with regards to the unallotments. I think you all know that local governments are united in being opposed to levy limits, but to the extent that we do have them, there is an element of accountability and transparency for the actions that you take in the basic mechanics of levy limits, where we're establishing an initial adjusted levy limit base, and then from that base is subtracted in county's instance county program aid, and in city's instance local government aid. This language was basically put in place to comport with the department practices for this past levy year for taxes payable in 2010, and it certainly was, you know,
Mr. Carlson, somebody's cell phone's on. That's what's picking up the buzz. So if you have a cell phone around this, even if you have it on silent, you have to turn the volume, you have to turn the power off, or that'll continue. So, Mr. Carlson, sorry.
Madam Chair, it's possibly
mine. It usually is somebody right in there, so that's okay. Just, I'm sure you can talk and power it down at the same time.
I thought it was only BlackBerries. Madam Chair, what happened in this past year for the tax payable in 2010 is when our levy limits were certified for this year, our levy limits were certified as if we would be receiving $230 million of county program aid before taking into account the unallotments, which cut those aids to $164 million. The consequence of that is that for our discussions with our boards in indicating that to them what levy authority they have before taking into account specials, basically the authority for what was ultimately a $67 million cut disappeared. So we were levying as if we were going to receive the full amount of county program aid, even though we knew at the time we were going to get $67 million less. And the impact of the language then is that, but you can turn around in 2011 in this particular instance and reclaim them. I'm just suggesting to you that basically to the extent that an unallotment is known before levy limits are certified, which is in September 1st of every year, that a cut is frankly a cut. It doesn't matter whether it's legislated by you or whether it's done through an unallotment. That both should be captured in the levy limits for purposes of transparency and accountability. That's my message. I'll be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Is there other public testimony on the Governor's Department of Revenue technical bill? Further questions from the committee? If not, we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, everyone from Revenue, for being here. And we want to get to Represent Paymar's bill now. So please join us.
Jim, did we do your bill?
So
Welcome. Represent Dabney.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 2329 to the Committee for Possible Inclusion in the Omnibus Tax Bill.
Okay, Representative Dabney moves 2329 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Tax Bill. Welcome to the committee, Representative Paymar, and guests. And
thank you, Madam Chair. I have an amendment to the bill.
Okay. Like Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A-10-2206 amendment to be amended to the bill.
Discussion of the amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, for your help with this. And House File 2329 is a bill put together by Deed and the City of St. Paul. It essentially provides some potential tools for the efforts to retain and grow jobs in Minnesota's only automotive manufacturing plant. As you all know, the Ford Motor Company has committed to closing the plant in St. Paul, which produces the Ranger, and this is supposed to happen in 2011. I'm just going to say a few things, but Mayor Coleman will explain the efforts that we've put forth so far with the Ford Motor Company to date, and then Mark Lucas will talk a little bit about the details of the bill, and then we have Rhonda Danielson from the United Auto Workers who would also like to talk about this from the perspective of labor. As you know, the Ford is literally the cornerstone of my district. It's been a great corporate citizen over the years. It's been in the Highland Park neighborhood since 1990. And I just want to say that the Ford plant doesn't just mean jobs for my district. It means jobs throughout the region. There's currently 750 jobs at the Ford plant and 150 contract workers there, which is down significantly from the 2,300 workers that were once at the plant. 20% of the remaining workers live in Ramsey County. The other 80% live in surrounding counties. These are good jobs. They're good union jobs. They pay family-supporting wages. We also, as you know, back in 1996, the state bonded for a training facility that is still operational at the plant. This is a difficult time, and we're looking for some avenues here through some incentives not only retain those 900 jobs, but perhaps add significantly to the job force by retooling this plant. And so in a time when we're looking to create jobs, sometimes the state and the city and the county need to do extraordinary things. This bill has some issues still. It's a work in progress, but I think that we want to move forward, and it's with the partnership of all the jurisdictions, I think we can be successful. So with that, I turn it over to Mayor Coleman.
Thank you, Representative Paymar. Welcome, Mayor Coleman. Nice to see you.
Welcome, Madam Chair. Thank you for having us, members of the committee. I'm glad to be here today. For the record, I'm Chris Coleman, Mayor of the City of St. Paul. I want to thank Representative Paymar and members of the committee for their support of this bill. I also want to thank members of the United Auto Workers and members of the administration that have been very helpful. We have representatives here from the Port Authority and from our Department of Planning and Economic Development that have been very active in putting together a package here that we think might be helpful in retaining those jobs there at the Ford site. As Representative Paymar mentioned, this is about retaining and growing jobs in the state of Minnesota. You can't talk about job creation until you first start talking about job preservation, and we have an opportunity, I believe, to preserve some jobs here on the Ford site. Originally, there were 2,300 jobs at that site, I think at its peak. While we have had a significant reduction of that peak number, we still have 750 jobs on the site that we would like to be able to at least retain, if not grow from that number. In 2005, shortly after I was elected mayor of the city of St. Paul, there's an article in the Wall Street Journal that said that Ford had slated this plant to close. I thought, boy, this is getting off to a wonderful start here to have your largest manufacturer leaving town. But the fact of the matter is that decision was confirmed a couple of months later officially by Ford. When we initially talked, I know that the governor talked with representatives from Ford. I talked with representatives from Ford. Other legislators and elected officials did as well. They were not interested in putting a package together or really said there was not much that we could do. But what we have seen over the last several months and years, as the auto industry has shaken out from their challenges, we've seen other states that have been successful in putting packages on the table that have retained jobs. Michigan, Kentucky, Ohio, Missouri have put packages on the table. Illinois put a package on the table that will help 1,200 jobs come to the city of Chicago or the Chicago area. And so it was kind of in that context that I went to the governor's office with our staff and asked to work with the state to figure out what we could do to potentially give some incentive for Ford to retool their facility on the site and continue to manufacture jobs. We know that the auto industry is changing. It's changing very dramatically, but we think that we can be an important part of that, especially given the proud history of that site. It's an important employer in the city of St. Paul, and it has always had one of the most productive workforces in the entire Ford system. So as we have seen other manufacturing facilities go, and even great companies like 3M that really grew with the city of St. Paul are now kind of in St. Paul by way of Maplewood more so. The remaining vestiges of the 3M facilities are gone. We've seen Schmidt, Brewery, Hams, Exxon, other facilities that have gone. We think it's critically important that we do everything that we can to preserve these jobs and hopefully grow. We don't know for sure that that our efforts here today will result in a decision to reverse the decision that has already been made at Ford, but we do know that in the absence of that, the redevelopment of the site is problematic, and at the very least will take a very, very extensive period of time. We're not sure about what the soil conditions are. We don't know how much remediation would have to occur. We don't know about what other opportunities there might be. What we are most fearful of is having this incredibly important corner of the city of St. Paul remain dormant for an extended period of time. It has been an important part of our community. We think it has a important future, and we would love the assistance of the state to put a package together that we can bring to Ford and hopefully change the outcome.
Thank you. Mayor Coleman. Who would like, did you want to speak next?
Yes.
And then I think we'll probably have questions for everyone. Welcome.
Thank you. Again, my name is Rhonda Danielson, and I'm proud to have the honor to say that I am the president of the UAW Local 879. I would first like to thank the 750 UAW members whom I represent for all their hard work and dedication they have shown over the last 3 years. We have made sacrifices in the loss of benefits, such as pay raises, cost of living advances, and pay for scheduled holidays. We have taken additional pay cuts to assist with the survival of Ford Motor Company and our Twin Cities assembly plant. The UAW, along with Ford and the contracted employees, have weathered the bad economy. The loss of a shift in 2007, a reduction of our workforce from 2,300 members to currently a little over 750, and two plant closings in 2008 and 2009. Despite all the challenges our membership and the plant have had to face in the last 3 years, we here at Twin Cities Assembly have managed to win numerous awards, such as the J.D. Powers and Associates Award for the highest in initial quality midsize pickup in 2008 and 2009, the Harbor Report Award for Efficiency for 2009, and the North American President's Quality Award for 2008 and 2009. When it comes to building a safe quality vehicle for the consumer, Local 879 UAW members are second to none. Our history shows that, and the awards we continue to receive back it up. We are the best in class. The working environment has changed a lot since I hired in at Ford. Instead of continuous confrontation between workers and management, there is a newfound mutual understanding that we must cooperate and work together in order to survive not only the economy of the United States, but the global economy as well. The work environment found within the walls at Twin Cities Assembly is not found anywhere else in the UAW Ford facility. The cooperation between our UAW members and Ford management has set a benchmark for which other plants are striving to follow. In the last 3 years, we have worked together to keep our plant open and continue to stay a viable resource for Ford, the City of St. Paul, and the state of Minnesota. Annually, the local UAW membership's wages generate over $40 million in gross taxable wages for the state of Minnesota. Along with the UAW workers, Twin Cities Assembly pays vendors and contractors such as Aerotech for salaried employees, Aristio, Albers, and Collins for skilled trades employees, and Marsden for janitorial services. There are about 130 non-Ford skilled trades workers, 25 contract employees, and 18 agency employees. These additional jobs generate an additional $10 million in taxable wages. They support the production of our plant. Then finally, add on the local Ford management income of around $3.5 million taxable wages. You also need to consider the rail workers and the truck drivers as well. Each day, for example, over 20 rail cars and 75 semi-trucks arrive with production materials. These suppliers and other supporting organizations generate taxable income for the state of Minnesota. All these jobs will be lost if production at Twin Cities Assembly stops. So in conclusion, this legislation should not only ensure that the current base automotive industry valued at over $54 million in wages continue to exist. It should encourage expansion in automotive industries that support assembly to move closer, creating more jobs for the state. I am confident that you will make the right decision and work together to ensure the survival of Twin Cities Assembly Plant and the survival of the team of hardworking employees found within. I would like to thank the chair and the committee for their time and consideration.
Thank you. And I want to make sure, is it Ms. Danielson or Davidson? I'm sorry.
Danielson.
Danielson. Okay, thank you. Yeah. Appreciate it. Mr. Loftus, did you want to talk to us too?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair. Thank
Please.
You. Mark Loftus from DEED. I had provided a handout we brought just this morning, a one-page handout that I had given to the pages if you would like that to be available.
Okay,
didn't get
it's coming
it before,
out now.
Didn't get it earlier, but it summarizes the proposal, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to add some background on as far as our department and the administration. This is has the governor's support. It was announced in his State of State speech that we would attempt to create what he described as a CAR zone. CAR, C-A-R, stands for Create Automotive Recovery. We do our best to come up with clever or not acronyms.
Even the author is trying not to laugh right now. That's okay.
Madam Chair, within that CAR zone, it gives us an opportunity to compete for further investment by Ford or by other companies. And I want to stress that we all want to make sure that we continue to have quality jobs in St. Paul, and that's a state goal as well. We do know, though, that Ford has announced that at some date certain out in the future, maybe a year and a half or two, or it's not specific, Ranger truck sales have been doing well enough to keep the plant open, but they have said that it will close. And when that day comes, we'd like to have Minnesota be one of the few states that has proactively put a package together so that we can talk with Ford or other companies even before that date comes to make a proposal which will allow us to provide incentives that will help us, frankly, compete with other states. As the mayor noted, other states, including Illinois, have created significant incentives for job creation. In the case of Illinois, at the Ford Explorer plant, Michigan has provided $188 million in job credits and tax credits for battery pack production. And that's based on a $450 million investment. And Kentucky has also put significant incentives, up to $180 million, into a truck plant in Kentucky. So in all of that context, we want Minnesota to be able to have something significant to offer to talk to Ford now and in the interim before the Ranger production ends, and to make these incentives available for other companies. So within the context of the CAR zone proposal, we have based it on the nature of the benefits that are provided in the current Job Z program. What we'd be talking about doing is creating a site, a zone, around the current Ford facility, and provide a series of benefits within that, including corporate income tax, state and local property tax. But I have to mention that the value of the land will still be taxed as it is under Job Z, and school district levies are not included in the exemptions. So those would continue to be unaffected under the proposal. There would be sales tax exemptions for those goods that are not already exempt from manufacturing sales tax exemptions. And what is different about this proposal, Madam Chair, is that we have added a job retention and creation credit. So based on 750 jobs, there would be a refundable credit of $2,500 if those are kept, if those jobs are maintained, and a credit of an additional $1,000 based on additional jobs at the site. So it's both retention and a creation incentive. And that's the one obvious new element that is not in the current job zone statute. And just to kind of in summary, I'd like to say that we have a tremendous set of assets here in Minnesota. The UAW representative talked about the tremendous asset of the workforce, which is the best Ford workforce in North America. And we have a tremendous facility there, too, that, as I have learned in this process of this project, that was selected by Henry Ford and Thomas Edison, standing on the bluff of the river there, selecting that site for a Ford manufacturing plant. So it has great history. We'd like to be able to support that into the future. And this gives us an opportunity to help that long-term investment be maintained in the Highland Park neighborhood of St. Paul. So, Madam Chair, the administration supports this. We're happy to work with St. Paul and local officials on making this happen.
Thank you, Mr. Loftus. Questions from Representative Solberg and then Representative Anderson. Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, and sir, on that facility, probably 12 or 14 years ago, we built an educational facility. The state built it for with $5 million. What is the status of that particular facility?
Madam Chair,
Representative Hamer.
That was my predecessor. You served with him, Representative Orenstein, who
It was Governor Carlson's proposal as well.
It passed the bonding bill, I think, capital investment bill in 95 or 96, and it's being used by Ford. The training facility
yes,
is being used.
But, Madam Chair, my concern, I think it was, if I recall, I don't know if it was cash or bonding. It might have been a cash, but if it's a bonding, it puts some additional restrictions on its use in the future. And that's basically my question is I don't recall if it was cash or bonding, but there are some restrictions, and I want to know what the plan is for that restriction.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Solberg and I, because I was chairing education, we had Ways and Means, and all those worked on that together. It was a cooperative invention. I think it was cash. It came in very late.
I think so, too.
But it was a cooperative venture involving St. Paul Technical College and time, and I guess it raises the question of what happens to the training facilities if the plant, in fact, were to close, being it was a cooperative venture, and the city was involved in that planning process as well. So I had essentially the same question.
Mayor Coleman.
Madam Chair and Representatives, it is my understanding that the obligation of Ford to repay whatever they were given is still outstanding, and that would have to be a part of the deal if they were to close that facility. It is being used heavily.
Yes, daily.
And that has been always one of our strongest pitches to Ford, is to say that, you know, you have this facility here, you have this relationship, you're going to have to pay back some of the additional resources, so that's kind of a little extra incentive. So unless someone from the Port Authority or from the Planning and Economic Development Department behind me corrects me, which they wouldn't really ever do.
they just left.
I'm pretty sure that at least in terms of the state's, you know, participation in that would have to be repaid. But if Ford goes away, the basis for the training facility, you know, as we look to redevelop that site, there wouldn't be much use for that particular training site.
Representative Anderson, then Garner, then Lesh. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Paymar, in the bill it says that they would qualify if they manufacture motor vehicles that have a superior fuel economy to what they currently are producing there. Can you tell me what is the fuel economy efficiency of a Ford Ranger?
Ms. Danielson? Is that?
Yeah,
who knows the...
Maybe. It's...
Representative Paymar.
I would just be guessing. I know it gets good gas mileage for the
depending on which motor it is. Yeah. You know, the 2.3 is going to get a better gas mileage than the 4.0.
Okay. Can you give me a ballpark figure?
Anderson.
Between 14 and 19 on a 4.0, and then it's up in the between 19 and 24 on a
4.0.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I think that Representative Anderson might be looking at the original
yes.
bill rather than the amendment. Where
oh.
was that?
I think we're just trying to figure that out, too.
Oh.
Representative Anderson, yeah, I think that's
right,
the
you.
Amendment changed that, I think.
Okay, very good.
So
thank
if
you.
There's...
This was Madam Chair, this was originally a Representative Dabney's bill who worked with Senator Anderson, and so it's changed since the governor's state of the state address.
Great, thank you. Okay, and this may be a time, Representative Paymar, for you and I just to talk on the record here so people understand. Representative Paymar and I have been talking about this, and there's discussion ongoing. Representative Dabney had introduced this before, last year, in fact, and this is a governor's initiative, and Representative Paymar is carrying the bill, and this is about a site in St. Paul. So there was discussion about trying to get the site specific just to this proposal, which the amendment did. So that makes the revenue estimate inaccurate for the sake of the committee, for understanding. But the committee knows that we have not been hearing bills that authors didn't pay for. Okay, so what's this one doing here? And like the one before it, and when we heard Representative Downey's Angel Credit, and we heard Representative Downey's, what we've been doing is saying if the we gave the governor sort of an extra leave that everyone else doesn't get, which is he can propose things that he's not paying for. And so all the authors who've done this bipartisanly, we're letting them do it too. Okay, so when the governor put out the, you know, his angel credit, he's got it in the out years, and in his proposal for this, it's in the out years. So members are maybe are trying to figure out why are we hearing some of these bills that the authors don't actually show the revenue source that's going to pay for them because they cost money. And that's because we decided to do that with the governor's budget rather than sort of drill down and make everything get paid for. So that's how this bill is in here. But if this committee is going to want to do this, we've got to pay for it. Like everything else that bipartisanly authors are proposing and the governor's proposing around the bucket of jobs. I mean, that's sort of the one thing people are saying, you know, all the tax cuts are for jobs and the CARSEs for jobs and the angels for jobs. And so in the end of the day, we're all going to have to pay for it because the committee hasn't been interested in, you know, pushing it to the out years. So we're all going to have to get creative if we want to get these things done. But we'll put you on the list, Representative Gardner, then Lesh, then Downey. Were you on that point?
To that point.
Sure, Representative Downey.
Just very briefly, and I know this is a limitation of this committee, but clearly the governor's budget balances all of these tax initiatives on the spending, on the expenditure side. We don't have the ability here, Madam Chair, so just an overall point that, you know, if the chair would want to grant the governor the courtesy of offering these bills, recognizing that on the expenditure side he's quote-unquote paying for them through cuts, I think that's an important distinction to make.
Well, I have to just profusely disagree with that. The governor's putting the cost of most of his initiatives into the future. He's not paying for them this year. He's got zeros on the spreadsheet pretty much for most of these initiatives, and they're projected out into the future for someone else to figure out. So I think the governor should come forward, and he can do, to pay for them, he can do more cuts right now. He has some cuts. But he also has a whole bunch of things going out into the future, and his budget proposal assumes new revenue. So we aren't quite there, but I think if folks want to, you know, we think the governor can get there by cutting more. He doesn't need to raise taxes to buy his programs. He can cut another $800 million, and he would have met that test. So we are trying to give governor an extra advantage that no one else in this committee has gotten. And so therefore, we're going to let the authors, whether they're paying for them or not, and like we've already done, like I said, with the angel hearing, the authors didn't pay, tell us how they would pay for that. And, you know, we are going to, the tax committee isn't going to send out a bill with a whole bunch of costs into the future. So we are going to have to pay for it either with revenue or with deeper cuts than the governor. So, you know, I just have to respectfully disagree with you. I don't think it lines up. So if there was anything else on that point, otherwise, we'll go back to the list. So, Representative Lesh. Oh, Gardner. You're crossed out. You got crossed out here before I called on you. So, Representative Gardner.
Yeah, thanks. I've actually been waiting a couple days.
I know that. I know that.
Mayor Coleman, I want to thank you and also the folks at the Port Authority for being aggressive and conserving jobs at Rock 10 also, which is the number two manufacturer in the city of St. Paul. Madam Chair, maybe staff, I was curious about the assumptions on revenue estimate. You said that that's now wrong, but I'm wondering about the logic here, because if we are, let's say we assume that nothing happens to the site after Ford leaves, there's no revenue from employee payroll deductions and other sorts of taxes coming from that. So you have zero coming in, and then this revenue estimate assumes that we are losing revenue to the state, but I'm just curious whether we factor in the fact that we're getting something and not nothing. Does that make sense?
Ms. Templin, you want to jump in on how the revenue, or maybe we should ask the department to put the revenue estimate together, which Mr. Loftus didn't do, but we could ask the, Mr. Loftus to take a crack at it.
Maybe Deed has even figured this out.
Well, Deed doesn't do revenue estimates, so, but that's fine, Mr. Loftus.
Madam Chair, let me just point out one thing that about the bill, that no benefits could be obtained under the program until after December 31, 2011, so it would be calendar 2012. And I want to be clear on record that was our mistake in telling revenue that it would not be before 13 and 14. I'm sorry, 10, 11,
12,
14, 15.
14, 15, 14, yeah.
14, 15. Okay. I'm sorry. It's we're looking at the math of when the plant could close at the end of 2011. The retrofitting could actually begin to occur in 2012, which would put it some of that, probably most of it, into fiscal year 13. That's why any numbers you've seen so far have not reflected a cost on the budget. We still have to work with revenue to accomplish that. Okay. So I wanted you to be aware of that.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Templin?
Madam Chair, Representative Gardner, just for the record, Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Analysis. As the chair mentioned, that this is you do have a revenue estimate in front of you completed, and the assumptions are just show the revenue loss for this proposal. The any revenue gain from withholding is not incorporated into the analysis. You don't see any net figures here for withholding and revenue loss from the tax benefits being provided in the proposal. One of the first estimates that are assumptions that revenue makes is in the first year the average revenue loss per business is $230,000, and after that the revenue loss per participating business is $50,000.
Okay, Representative Gardner.
I guess the key strategic question I'm trying to answer is if we do nothing and the site is vacant after Ford leaves, does the state lose more?
Madam Chair, to that point, hang on a second, because three people just tried to answer your rhetorical question. Did you?
Rhetorical, so they can answer.
Yeah, right. This will help before we jump to those three. If you look at the revenue estimate members, then it's not for the Paymar bill. Okay, so let's be clear on that. This is for originally as proposed by the governor. Go to the revenue analysis detail at the bottom. The total cost of this proposal is $22 million. So that factors in all the years. Okay, so Representative Paymar is not proposing that, but that gives you a kind of an insight to the total rather than, you know, looking in this biennium or the next or the next. So I hope that helps. So responding to Representative Gardner's comment was Representative Anderson and then Silver. I know, there was a reaction over there. I saw the sun quickly, but I wasn't sure who it was.
It must be this side of the room.
Thank God.
But Representative Gardner, I mean, you hit on a great point, and this is the issue that we have been having all along this entire session, is that the tax structure that we have in Minnesota is making it so businesses are leaving the state. And we are at a desperate, critical time right now where we're having to do everything that we can to try and get these folks to stay here, because it does matter. It does matter because all those individuals that are employed by these companies, they contribute income taxes, they contribute property taxes, they contribute to the what we know as Minnesota as a great state to live in. And when we enact policies, whether they're regulatory or tax policies or whatever spending measures that we do, that has an impact on the businesses that we have in this state. And that's why it's important that we do as much as we can to keep these businesses here so we can keep the employees and the talent that we have coming from the state, rather than seeing them go to Wisconsin, seeing them go to the Dakotas, Iowa, or heaven forbid, even the East and West Coast. So I'm glad that you pointed that out. I'm glad to see that you're on board for this measure. Representative Gardner.
But what I'm trying to, the problem we found out when we talked to Commissioner Reines on this is we don't know how to account for it. And so I'm just curious if the revenue estimate takes that into account. I'd like to believe that. And it's easier on a, say, a bonding bill than it is on the tax side. But we are talking about a specific site where, because of a decision made somewhere else, you know, the product isn't even going to be made anymore. So we're not talking about whether we're going to make Rangers here or in Venezuela or someplace else.
Can we go?
Madam Chair,
somebody Anderson, please.
If I remember correctly, when Dr. Wilson talked about this issue, it wasn't that we couldn't account for it, it's just that we don't. And I think that begs the question of why aren't we trying to figure out how our policies that we pass here at the legislature impact the economy overall. And that's, you know, I've got a bill for that, so hope that you can sign on to it, because I think it's important for us to do, because as policymakers and decision makers for the state, if we don't know how we impact the economy by the decisions that we can't make good decisions.
Okay, on that point, Solberg and Liebling.
Well,
Sam Solberg.
Madam Chair and members, we don't do that same accounting when we ask for a fiscal note.
Right.
Yeah, besides, if we expend some money, if we how many jobs do we save if we save GAMC? Or do we expect those jobs to be cut? How about other things? And if we meet with the business community, they're concerned about education and educated workforce, and that was one of the points that was brought out. That doesn't come from the sky. It's because the taxpayers have stepped up and funded education, particularly higher education. And we can't have the policies that we say, well, we're going to let that go by the wayside. And Representative Anderson, you sound like a great candidate to give a big tax break to Ziggy Wolf so we can make sure that the Vikings stay here.
Okay, to this point is Liebling, then it's Representative Lesch. I just want to ask before Representative Liebling asks a question, is Ford here? I would guess they're not. It's proprietary. You know, I've never heard that Ford left the site because of the taxes. I've never ever heard that, but I would love to get information from Ford. It was just asserted it was the tax climate, and I've never heard that about this site ever, but maybe Ford could let us know, and maybe St. Paul could talk to Ford and get that information to us, because I've never heard that. Well, Mayor Coleman?
Madam Chair, first of all, you know, I don't want to weigh too much into your discussions here, but we have had extensive discussions, and obviously this is, you know, there are the auto industry in this globe is changing dramatically. It's changing very quickly. People are making decisions. You know, Ford was the one company out of all the American manufacturers that was in a little bit better position, but they were hurting dramatically. There were a lot of things that weighed very much in the favor of the site, including a hydroelectric plant. So they're not only were they using green power, they were using reliably cheap power. They had the most efficient workforce in their entire system, and there were a lot of things to do this. So, you know, as with all of these decisions about why companies choose to stay or go or come or whatever, the fact of the matter is there's probably 10 or 15 or 20 criteria that any company is going to use. Taxes are one of them. Cost of labor is one of them. But so is an educated workforce, quality of life, et cetera, et cetera. The one thing I will say, and I think that what this bill points out, what we know for sure, and we've done a lot of work on this in St. Paul, and there's a regional effort as well, that unless we as a state and a region get a lot more aggressive about going after these jobs, about targeting companies, about not just kind of passively allowing some of these companies to walk out, then we will not have these jobs. And so I think that this act here today is a very strong statement from the state of Minnesota and from the community that we do want to actively and aggressively pursue these jobs. And when we do that, we at least have a chance to compete, not just against, you know, neighboring communities, but across the globe.
Thank you. Representative Liebling?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't need to say too much because Representative Solberg said it very well, and I was really going to make the same comment. I mean, we keep going over the road here because we keep hearing the same mythology about the problem is that we have a bad tax climate here. And, it's true. Spending also, when we cut spending, we also are cutting jobs. And, we don't count that either. We don't account for that. And so I'm just kind of tired of hearing the same mythology over and over again. You know, we've had basically the same kind of tax policy for quite a few years in this state. And a lot of companies come here, and a lot of companies do stay here and have done very well until this recession. So, you know, I don't think that we're certainly not the only state that's having fiscal problems. You know, let's not pretend that, you know, everybody's just going everywhere else and we're just sitting here with a bad economy uniquely among the states. It's just not the case.
Thank you, Representative Lash, then Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Paymar, for bringing this forward and taking over from Representative Dabney. And it's another line in a good incarnation of good ideas from Job Z to Green Z to this Car Z, great name. And of course, the Twins ballpark, which was Ball Z. That was Representative Dabney, so I stole it from him. That was voluntary. Representative Gardner's question answered one of the ones that I had, and I think the other question I had was answered by those who had the questions about which state with a more favorable tax climate did these jobs disappear to, and I think that question has been thoroughly answered. But I would ask this. I know that during the time when this site was originally chosen, one of the benefits was that free or cheap source of hydroelectric power. Now, as I understand it, that's gone now. I think the MAC bought it. Somebody bought it. Well, Mayor's shaking his head. Somebody got it. How does that change how this site appeals to Ford or a different manufacturer that would do more efficient jobs on the site?
Representative Paymar or Mayor Coleman?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, we don't actually know because those documents between the purchaser of the hydro facility and Ford are very confidential. So we don't know whether there is a specific provision in there that allows Ford to retain it if the site for some reason is to go on, or they have specific rights to the power that is created there. So it is possible. We just don't know whether or not there's some kind of internal agreement, and we probably won't know that.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two comments. First of all, in response to the state getting aggressive to in the area that when businesses are leaving to try to capture them and lure them back, or at least present some sort of a package that might make them have a pause and possibly stay. Because of being in the Small Business Caucus, we had lots of people bring issues forward, and one of them got brought back too late in order for the whole consensus around from the Small Business Caucus. But Representative Mason does have a bill that does require a deed to look at those types of the businesses who are leaving and have a fast response team to go in and talk with them and see what it is that they're leaving for, and if there's something that we can remedy here in order to make them stay. So just to that thought. And then the other thing that I just, the other reflection that I have is that, you know, we've spent a couple of years on trying to address property taxes here and to fund the issues that are so important at the state level of education and transportation and those types of things. And when we did our small business survey, property taxes was the tax that was most burdensome for a small business. So I want to make sure that when we talk about taxes, we start zeroing in on really some of the real problems so that we can find the real solutions. And I think of all the property tax proposals that Representative Marquardt has brought to us in the past couple of years, and I just really look back with regret and saying I wish that at least we could have adopted one of them. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Paymar, we adjourn at 12. Closing wrap-up, and we're going to be taking public testimony at the governor's proposal. We didn't get through it all on Monday. And so more public testimony, you know, this is in the governor's proposal, can be taken at that time for this bill, too, if there is anyone else.
Madam
but
Chair,
Representative Paymar.
I would just thank the committee for hearing the bill. We put some things together rather quickly here since the governor's state of the state. I appreciate Deed working with us on this, and we have a good partnership. We want to make sure that we have some issues with Ramsey County that need to be worked out. And Ford has been calling me, and I'm going to turn all that negotiating over to Deed and to the mayor. But I think we have a good partnership, and I just hope we can move this ahead.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Appreciate you being here, Mr. Mayor, Ms. Danielson. We're adjourned.